Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
The Athletic.
The race is on, and Formula One's next big controversy is already building some momentum, centering on the possibility of Porsche and Audi coming into F1 in 2026. But isn't that a good thing? And what exactly is causing the latest paddock arguments? I'm Ed Shaw, and joining me to unravel this web of intrigue are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Scott, hello, you've come dressed for a football match.
I thought I'd just enjoy a rare bit of time back home after the quite crazy run of travelling for the early flyaways by repping Stockholm on the podcast. So yeah, I'm wearing my Djurgården football shirt. But actually, as we sit here and record this now, our big Stockholm rivals, Hammarby, have literally just kicked off their Easter weekend match.
This is a big one because I went to a Hammarby match, or Hammarby, I should say, a few years ago because you got me paying attention to Swedish football. So I more go with the Hammarby side just so I can have a local rival to you. So that's a big game. And Mark Hughes, anything to say about Swedish football?
I can tell you absolutely nothing about that subject. Zero.
You know what football is?
Vaguely, yeah. But Swedish football, no.
It's a lot like English football, just not quite as good. I think that's the summary.
Oh, that's a bit unfair. Depends which part of English football you're talking about.
Well, that's a good question. Let's say it's at least lower profile than English football. That's probably the thing we can all agree on. But, well, agreement is something we're going to be talking about quite a lot during this podcast, or the lack thereof. So, Scott, let's get down to it. There's been a lot of talk about Porsche and Audi coming into F1 for ages. Even before that, fans have been frustrated by mooted plans for them to coming to absolutely nothing. So what exactly is the plan? And actually, should fans be excited by the prospects or cynical, given the series of disappointments over in the case of Porsche, it's been decades, hasn't it?
Yeah, I understand I understand why people would be cynical. I'm sure there are people listening to this right now, and what we say is probably going to make a few of them roll their eyes. Because it's very much a case of I'll believe it when I see it when it comes to the VW Group. But I do believe that they are closer than ever. There was a meeting of I'm going to butcher exactly what it's called, but for simplicity's sake, the supervisory board of the Volkswagen Group, which includes obviously senior management from both the Porsche and Audi brands. And there was a meeting in the week before the Australian Grand Prix, and they agreed on potential plans to enter Formula One. And it was a statement that they put out that had a lot of caveats in it. Ultimately, what does it mean to confirm a potential plan? And I think what they've done is that they've agreed internally now the way in which they want to go F1 racing with those respective brands. Doesn't mean that they're 100% going to do that, but if it comes off, if they decide to pull the pin and go for it, then the way it would work in theory is that Porsche will partner up with Red Bull. I think that is pretty much about as done as anything like this can be done, subject to absolute final sign-off. And that will be a collaboration that is a bit of a glorified sort of branding deal. I don't really see Porsche, at least initially, feeding in massively to, you know, the internal combustion engine design or the energy recovery system. I think that will be primarily a Red Bull powertrains project with Porsche's name, basically. But I'm sure they will feed in some engineers and build that up over time. That is obviously a slightly cost effective way for Porsche to get into Formula One by piggybacking onto another manufacturer's infrastructure and investment and all of this. Where it gets interesting is Audi, because Audi do want to enter Formula One as well. But they don't want to do it the way Porsche are doing it. So rather than be part of a VW Group Red Bull collaboration, Audi want to do their own thing. They want to build their own engine. I believe they would use the abandoned Porsche V6 that was which was built and actually dyno tested a few years ago before Porsche's then plan to enter Formula One had to be put on ice because of the Dieselgate scandal that VW got dragged into. And then they would have to find a team to then buddy up with. But Audi also don't want to just be an engine supplier like Honda was in the past. They want to be much more involved. I think they want to stake in a team, if not run and own a team outright. So two very different proposals from two brands within the same group. It's a very interesting way of going about things. It's different to what was originally planned. But if it all comes off, and I know that that's the big if that everyone's waiting for, sounds like an awful lot of fun, to be honest.
Fun, certainly. But I have to say, we did a podcast at some stage last year talking about this and how logical it would be for the Volkswagen Audi group to use multiple brands with the same project. All made perfect sense linking up with Red Bull. But Mark, it seems to have drifted into this weird thing of two separate projects for the same group. That doesn't sound very efficient or logical. So what do you make of the mission creep that seems to have developed here?
Yeah, I think that's from the fact that although the all three brands, Volkswagen, Porsche and Audi, are under the Volkswagen Group umbrella, they are actually run as separate companies and they do have their own very ambitious management at heading each of those companies. And they do have a history actually of competing against each other in motorsport with separate projects. We've seen it in WEC, we've seen it in Formula E. It's not in hindsight, it's less surprising, I guess, than it seems because, yeah, in terms of cost effectiveness and in terms of corralling your resources, it would seem, you know, when it's something as high cost and intensive as Formula One, it would seem odd to be tackling it in this way, but this is just seems to be part of the DNA of this group of companies that they do compete hard even against each other. So of the three, it's Audi which actually has the most still has in house the most of the motorsport engineers from the Le Mans project, and so. Yeah, I can see that there's been a big push that they want to have a crack at it under their own terms and not competing against their comrades at Porsche. So, yeah, it opens up many, many questions because it wasn't envisaged by F1 that that this was going to be the way Volkswagen was going to enter. And so I think it's created a lot of questions that weren't there before. How do you ensure that in terms of who gets the dyno hours, the extra allowances for the dyno hours, and the extra costs you're allowed to incur as a new entry, and who is a new entry and who isn't, and what's the IP transfer, and of course there's a lot of not mistrust, but a little bit of concern from the existing manufacturers. Well, hang on, is this really going to be two separate projects? How do we know that they're not collaborating? In which case, why should they get two lots of the benefits, etc.? So, yeah, it's a tricky one. It's a tricky one for Formula One to manage, but it's a nice problem for them to have in a way.
Yeah, it's better than not having enough engine suppliers. That's certainly the case. And of course, both of these manufacturers are fun ones to get into F1. Audi's got no F1 heritage unless you wish to let them have a bit of Grand Prix heritage from the Auto Union days, because Auto Union did sort of play a part in the formation of Audi, didn't it? Porsche has won a Grand Prix as a constructor, of course, plus provided the tag engines for McLaren, and most memorably, the underpowered, overweight, not very good Porsche V12 that Footwork used in 1991 briefly. So they've got the chance to make some new history there, but Scott, is your feeling that the position is basically that this is all provisionally approved, as it were, and it just needs some of the rules and that kind of thing to fall into place for the door to be opened? Or is there still some politicking and arguments within the Volkswagen Audi group to let this one actually happen? Because it's always difficult because we're dealing with boards here, aren't we? So that sometimes one vote on a board can swing things.
Yeah, well, obviously, like I mentioned, the past Porsche project that almost came to life a few years ago and had to be abandoned. That was pretty much about as advanced as a Formula One engine project can get before being canned. Like I said, they built a V6, they tested it on the dyno, and this wasn't just a single cylinder. It was a full V6, and they'd had an initial concept for an energy recovery system drawn up as well. So Porsche's plans in the recent past, were very far advanced, and then something as dramatic as the Dieselgate scandal can arise almost out of nowhere and just completely knock it on its head, because there are other considerations that a manufacturer has to answer to. And to be honest, it's obviously a very different example, but there has been another big external factor in the background now, not really even in the background, that has affected things, which is the crisis in Ukraine after Russia's invasion, which has had a massive impact on various industries and different parts of various industries. And the Volkswagen Group has felt that. There's been a big knock-on impact in terms of supply and cost and that kind of thing. So there are broader considerations for the VW Group. And that's why, for me, it's a bit... I understand why it's not a surprise from a sporting point of view to have two brands potentially enter F1 and compete against one another, because there is so much history for that. It's the financial element that seems a bit counterintuitive to me, because right at a point where things are the group has to be responsible and navigate through a slightly tricky situation, plus the fact that automotive companies are always having to justify everything they do, especially the bigger ones, they seem to be on the brink of making two separate significant financial commitments. If Audi is doing its a fully fledged works engine project and trying to buy into a team, that is an enormous expense that they are going to be committing to for a very long time, in theory, many, many years. That's a big thing to jump into. So I think that, like I said before, I think Red Bull Porsche, I think that could be signed off pretty easily. I don't think they've made their mind up 100%, because I do think everybody wants to see the new technical regulations just to be 100% sure. But it would take something big, I think, to stop Porsche coming in. Audi is a bit more complicated because they are going about it in a more complicated way. And I think they might have left one of the most difficult elements to last, which is to find a team to work with, because I'm sure we can get into this in a little bit more detail in a bit, but trying to convince a McLaren or a Williams or a Sauber or an Aston Martin, all the teams that they've been linked to actually buddy up, might not be quite as easy as I think Audi maybe assumed. But also, I think people, you know, fans might assume as well. These teams are in a stronger place than they were a few years ago. So I don't think it's that straightforward for Audi to get exactly what it wants for the price it's willing to pay.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot more still to happen here. And we should say, obviously, the timeline for this is 2026. That's the next generation engine, which is the MGUH gone. Much more powerful electrical motor on those cars, something in the region of 350 kilowatts they're talking about. So It's a good step, but it's not a completely electric engine or anything, as was mooted by some people at one stage. But it is going to completely sustainable fuels is the objective. So it's quite a big step, and it does at least go towards the direction the automotive industry is going, although it's not full electrification by any stretch of the imagination.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, Scott, all of this is what Formula One wants, isn't it? Effectively, it's two new manufacturer brands, however they do it. If you've got Porsche and Audi on the grid, that's great for F1. Mark ran through the, the myriad areas where there's problems here. But we're talking about this big row that's going on. So what exactly is the detail of what's being argued over? What's the key battleground in terms of shaping the 26 regulations that will get Audi and Porsche through the door without alienating the existing engine makers?
Well, there's sort of two elements to it, really. One is what actually defines a new manufacturer. And then the second part is what should a new manufacturer get as a bonus over the existing manufacturers. Now, Red Bull Powertrains exists already. Technically, the engines in the Red Bulls and the AlphaTauris on the grid this year are Red Bull Powertrains engines. That is what they are entered as, but we all know that they're just Hondas. They're designed by Honda, and they are being assembled and maintained and everything by Honda still this year, and they will continue to be so until 2025. So even though they bear the Red Bull Powertrains name, Red Bull Powertrains actually has nothing to do with it. The original plan was for Red Bull to take over the running of those engines from next year, but that's now changed. And a big part of why it's changed, as much as Red Bull Powertrains still not being completely ready for it, is because Red Bull want to do everything they can to make sure they are seen as a new power unit manufacturer in 2026. Obviously, a Porsche or Audi type would be a new manufacturer because there is no concurrent project or anything going on in the meantime while they're preparing for the 26 regs. So that's a bit clearer. But if you have Porsche and Red Bull buddying up, is that one new manufacturer or two new manufacturers? And therefore, you know, do they then get whatever the allowance is for a new manufacturer over an existing manufacturer? Does Red Bull and Porsche get their own one? And then Audi gets its own one as well. Because this is the heart of the concern, because once you've defined what a new manufacturer is, you have to work out what they get. These are the concessions that we've talked about on previous podcasts, and you'll see references to them in pretty much every article and every video we've ever made on the subject. It's all about, as Mark was outlining earlier, extra dyno time, extra money to be spent, a bit more money for capital expenditure projects as well when the engine manufacturer spending cap comes in. And the problem is, if you end up with a situation where Red Bull, Porsche and Audi are all classified as new manufacturers, does that mean they all get the extra dyno hours? Do they all get a full budget cap allowance? Do they all get extra money for this or that, whatever it is? And if they do, then that means a Red Bull Porsche engine is going to be designed and built and everything and developed with twice the resource, more than twice the resource of Mercedes, Ferrari and Renault, because they're getting two lots of an increased allowance, or a bigger allowance, shall we say. So that is that's a massive red flag to the existing manufacturers. And then to complicate it further, you do have, and again, Mark alluded to this, the third brand, Audi, which exists within the same umbrella group as Porsche, with its own allowance, doing its own engine development work. Now, if Audi is building its own engine, 100% it should be given new manufacturer status, and it should have a full allowance, it should have its own dyno time, it should have its own spending limit, completely separate to Porsche and Red Bull. Because in theory, there are going to be big fat walls erected between Audi and Porsche on an intellectual basis to protect the intellectual property. So they are going to be, in principle, completely separate engines. But because they exist within the same organization, there is a fear that there would be some kind of crossover. And then you have not only a Red Bull Porsche engine being built with two separate allowances, separate sets of resources on one project. Is there a way in which, even if the fear is that it just happens by osmosis, that Audi and Porsche end up with some crossover in terms of information? I think that is, I assume that that is less likely and less of a problem than simply one engine project benefiting from double the resource of anyone else. That's where I think the biggest red flag is at the moment.
Well, let's get Mark to adjudicate this one and sort it all out for F1.
I don't think there is an easy answer. I think there will always be an element of concern from the outside that the Audi and the Porsche programs are separate. If we make the assumption that Porsche will go along with Red Bull powertrains and that Audi does its own thing, the concern is always going to be, are they really separate? Is there any exchange of information behind the scenes? And that's just a natural concern. So they're going to have to be some very, very convincing ways, if they are going to indeed go their own separate routes technically, of demonstrating that, whether by checks or how it's monitored, I really don't know. And in terms of intellectual property, I think there might also be a concern from Honda about how much Honda intellectual property may go into the 2026 Red Bull powertrains engine if there is another automotive manufacturer involved in that. So there are all sorts of dimensions to this. I don't think there is an easy answer. I don't think so. I've been a bit rubbish at adjudicating it because I don't think there is an easy answer.
I'll take nuance over an easy answer any day.
That's often how it is, isn't it?
Asking Mark to adjudicate now explains why he turned up to this podcast dressed in a robe and one of those wigs and had a gavel on him. Though I didn't realise that's what it was for, but it explains it. Just to pick up on something he said about Honda there, it's quite interesting because I agree that there will be a concern on that side, but part of it is also because there are just constant whispers that Honda want back into Formula One for 2026, and if that's the case. And or even if they came in 2 or 3 years after that, because that would be a very Honda thing to do, quit, walk away, and then come back a bit too late after the start of the next set of regs and be behind, and then spend years spending an absolute fortune to build back up. But they're going to absolutely hate the idea of doing that if they know that their existing technology has been fed into another program. Because then they're basically fighting against themselves. They just, whether it's their race team or their engine, they just can't help themselves, can they? They're just constantly setting up other people to crack on and do a brilliant job with their own stuff.
The fate of Honda in Formula One. But it's a good point because it's never as simple as just being concerned that some Honda IP will be directly used. It's more the indirect use, isn't it? And if you've got somebody who gets used to working on or gets familiar with a Honda powertrain, they will know things about it that can be a knowledge that's applied to other things. You can't unlearn what you know, can you? It's just a simple fact of things. So it is a messy situation. Then you've got the whole other question with this question about how much they can spend on CapEx with Red Bull powertrains still expanding. And obviously, Christian Horner and Red Bull want Red Bull powertrains to be considered brand new. But by 2026, they'll have been on the grid with ostensibly, in name terms, their own engine. We know it's all done by Honda. For 4 years by then. So obviously Toto Wolff, for example, is pushing back about the idea of them being a new one. So what's amazing here is how many different strands there are. It's why Mark said it's so difficult, because there's so many different threads for people to pull on to try and further their own argument, as it were. It gets very, very difficult to reach that compromise without someone pulling the rug from under it.
We can actually go throw to Mark for another adjudication here, just on the point of Red Bull and arguing over what, you know, because obviously that naturally they think they should have greater concessions, and the CapEx allowance is one of them. In Christian Horner's argument for that, he said, regardless of your point, Ed, that by 2026 they'll have been around for 4 years or so and they'll have built this facility state of the art, fit for purpose, everything's been done, specced out for the 26 regs. But it's not enough. They already need to expand the site that they mapped out in the first place so that they can do more manufacturing on site. But Horner's point is they will have to keep expanding for years to come. And his argument was that they're going to be up against some manufacturers that have been developing their resources and facilities for 70 years. So I'd like Mark to rule on whether that's a valid point, because should we really believe that Renault, Ferrari or Mercedes are benefiting now from resources and facilities that they built in the 1950s?
Yeah, well, you know, going back to Ferrari's original engines, they inherited a lot of that from Alfa Romeo. So maybe we should bring Sauber in on the argument as well. because, you know, and those original engines were, you know, 1.5 litre V12s. So, you know, I think a lot of that is no. I throw that one out of court.
That's a great verdict. It's not just a no; it's a go home, don't come back. It does show the complexity, though, because the sad thing is that the cost control is the best solution to keeping things relatively sensible and level. But motorsport being what it is a resources-based business. So part of the game has always been spending as much as you can get your hands on, hasn't it, Mark? There's this fundamental tension. We see that in the team cost caps because there's all sorts of whispers about knowledge transfer and collaboration between Haas and Ferrari and AlphaTauri and Red Bull. Again, whether it's direct or indirect, this whole thing is a big philosophical problem for Formula One to solve. Maybe it's not even a philosophical problem. I think everyone agrees with the philosophy, but the detail and the reality of it makes it so complicated.
Yeah, it's just like in anything, you have different hats on and they stand outside the competitor themselves to try and create a better playing field for everyone, and they have a pretty good understanding of how that's done. And then they switch hats and become competitors. And then it's just about how you can maximize your own chances within the new set of circumstances. So that's always there. That's always just part of the sport.
Yeah, it just needs teams and engine manufacturers, to coin a phrase that Ross Brawn has been using for a few years, do need saving from themselves sometimes. So hopefully there'll be a final resolution. But 2026 is far enough away that this one can run and run for a while. So I'm sure there'll be plenty more stories and chat about this one. We'll get a little bit more into the engine shenanigans in a moment. But after last week's disappointment, Scott, I'm about ready to go again with my Grid Rival team. Grid Rival, it's a fantasy motorsport game. The race has its own league where you can take on Scott and me and very, very likely beat us. Still open for signups, creates plenty of selection challenges given the lineups are ever changing. So any quandaries for you this week, Scott, ahead of Imola?
Yeah, I need to free up a little bit of cash because I've got a couple of moves I want to make, which I'm not going to reveal on the in this chat right now because I am determined to beat you and I refuse to give you any ideas. But the where I've got to at the moment, I've left myself with too low a bank balance to actually fill my fifth driver slot. So I just need to reconsider and either release another driver early or downgrade my team, so that I can work that out. So it's a little bit tricky, but I have at least sort of, this was a bit more calculated. I knew that I was going to leave myself in this position of having to balance two or three spots this week. Whereas I think after Saudi, I think I just absolutely dropped the ball. Hadn't realised that I'd only signed a few drivers on shorter term contracts than I expected, and then accidentally found myself before the last race with four slots to fill, which was very, very difficult to do at the last minute.
Well, my strategy is very, very simple because I've got one slot and the only driver I can afford is Nicholas Latifi at the moment. So I think I'm going to have to free transfer one of my existing drivers to reshape. I'm thinking of getting rid of George Russell because he's gone up in price a bit. Get Fernando Alonso in, whose price has gone down because he hasn't had the results, and then see who I can get for that Latifi slot, because all I'll get from Latifi is he'll hit the wall or get driven into by someone.
Make sure you actually hit the deadline for this, because that Hammarby football match that I mentioned at the top of this podcast kicked off about probably an hour after you realised that the deadline for the Allsvenskan Fantasy League had passed. So make sure you don't make that mistake this time for Imola, Ed. For anyone listening that wants to know how the deadline works, can you inform them of when they need to lock in their team by?
It's normally just before qualifying, isn't it? So you could have a look at what goes on during practice, which is quite nice. Of course, sprint weekend this weekend, so that deadline will be on the Friday. So you'll get the chance to have a look in FP1 and then dive into it. I quite like the fact you can decide based on FP1 because it allows you to be engaged and pay attention and then make your changes accordingly. Although, of course, I might just like that because that gives us an advantage given we're normally at the circuit. So we perhaps have a little bit of extra information compared to most. But I'm hoping to turn around my season anyway. And of course, we'll be tracking the progress all the way through the year. So download the Grid Rival app or visit the website so you can join in. You find the link in the episode description for this podcast. Mark, let's get back to engines because we briefly talked about the potential for an Audi partner team. Where exactly are they going to get one from? Which team or teams do you think is likely? Because it really is a seller's market right now. A few years ago, before the financial landscape in F1 changed, it would have been much easier to buy a team. But now it's really difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The teams in are effectively franchises now, and with the cost caps in place, and the income beginning to rise, they're in a very good place. And so there's no guaranteed new entries. It's constantly being discussed whether there should be a couple of new slots opened or not. But there's been a bit of resistance to that, obviously, from the existing teams, because it means a smaller share of the cake for them. So, yeah, it's not just a case of offering an independent team some money and the opportunity to become a works team. I think a team like McLaren, for example, would put a very high value on its place in Formula One. Probably the most, I think probably the best chance that Audi has of a partner, I suspect, would be Sauber. It has a history of being either an independent or a works team. It was previously a BMW team. It began with an association with Mercedes back in the 90s. So I think that would probably be where I would see the most likely the most likely outcome of Audi trying to buy into a team and have a controlling interest in a team. And the facilities there are very good. It's got a good wind tunnel. It's very, very experienced. So yeah, it's not straightforward. You could make a case for any of the teams that they've been talking to, but yeah, that's where if I had to bet on it, I'd be betting on that.
Audi have done a bit of work with Sauber in the past, haven't they? They used the Sauber wind tunnel at times for the LMP1 project, so there's at least a little pre-existing relationship. But we have to say, Scott, this is not an easy team to buy, Sauber. They got some way towards a deal with the Andretti Group, very close to it, but then that all fell down. Again, it's a seller's market, isn't it? Because the ownership doesn't seem to particularly want to sell that team. So you've got to quite heavily incentivize them with some serious money.
Yeah, I think it's going to come down to what Audi's willing to pay and exactly how much control they're determined to take. Ultimately, any stake in a Formula One team, small, significant, majority, whatever it is you're aiming for, is going to come at an absolute premium now. If you look at what MSP Capital invested in McLaren, which would have been, under $200 million, for a minority share, significant, but a minority share. So, if you wanted to get more than a 50% stake in a team, any team, whether it's all four of the teams we've heard mentioned, McLaren, Williams, Aston Martin, and Sauber, it was only a few months ago that Zak Brown was saying that Formula One teams should be commanding billion-dollar valuations in the not-too-distant future. Who's to say we're not there already? Ultimately, the people that run these teams and own these teams are the ones that can put a value on the team, whatever they choose to put the value at. Like, that's the whole point of franchise value, is that they're protected, that they then dictate how they can dictate their own value. So let's say that all of those teams have put a $1 billion valuation on themselves, at least. Audi's going to have to stump up at least $500 million just to get involved from a point where they actually have a controlling stake in the team. I mean, that's asking a lot. So then you have to look at what the teams actually need, whether or not they're going to be able to be convinced. A few years ago, let's say 2018, because they were fighting over having the worst car in Formula One. Imagine in 2018, you suggested that McLaren and Williams would be able to look at an Audi offer and go, actually, no, we're okay. We don't need that. That would have been unthinkable a few years ago for them to be able to dismiss it out of hand. Now, I'm not saying that Williams or McLaren definitely 100% won't do a deal with Audi, because that could well happen. It all comes down to the terms being offered. But my money would probably be on Sauber or Aston Martin, because I just think there's a bit more flexibility there. Although I don't think Sauber's ownership really wants to just up and leave, there is ultimately an element there of, I think, being a bit open to selling if the terms are right. but it wouldn't be selling the team entirely. And Aston Martin, well, things keep going from bad to worse for Lawrence Stroll at the moment, whether it's on the F1 team side. Aston Martin Lagonda has obviously gone through difficult times and hasn't had the renaissance under his leadership that I think he would have hoped. So if he's got a manufacturer there that's willing to split the burden that he is shouldering at the moment, who's to say that he's not going to become more amenable to that? And then you get into myriad possibilities for all of these manufacturers of all of these teams, which is whether Audi would just do the engine supply deal with a view to taking a stake in the team, or engine supply plus a small take with a small stake with the view to expanding that stake into a majority control. There's loads of different ways to do this. It comes down to what exactly Audi settles on what is the bare minimum it would accept to get into Formula One at the moment, and then the price it will have to pay to achieve that, and whether it can find a team willing to do it. So it's absolutely fascinating, and this is why I think the Audi side of things is a bit more complex and a bit further from being resolved than the Porsche side.
I can certainly imagine a scenario whereby the notional cost that may have been proposed for Audi to buy a team or buy a chunk of a team is lower than the reality, which could harpoon any possible deal. A minority stake's one thing, but if they want full control and 50% plus, which you'd need to have full control, then that's going to be very, very expensive and difficult for them.
Hi, producer Johnny here, interrupting the show momentarily to tell you about Roan, a clothes brand we think you'd like. I don't know about you, but finding clothes you like can be tough. Sizes can vary from brand to brand, and fabrics can be poor quality or uncomfortable. We all know a good outfit can impact your confidence and help you feel your best, and that's where Roan comes in. Their range of stylish, functional, business casual menswear helps you look good without having to think about it. It's versatile, high quality and durable, and works in a range of social and professional settings. Roan's commuter collection includes products for every occasion, including the world's most comfortable pants, dress shirts, quarter zips, polos and blazers. It also features, and get this, wrinkle release technology and gold fusion anti-odor technology for more wears between washes, so you'll be fresh and clean all day long. Roan were kind enough to send me a shirt and some pants from the commuter collection, and I can tell they're going to be part of my wardrobe for a long time to come. The commuter collection could get you through any workday and straight into whatever comes next. Head to roan.com/race and use promo code race to save 20% off your entire order. That's 20% off your entire order when you head to rhone.com/race and use code race. It's time to find your corner office comfort.
Well, Scott, let's move on to F1 races now. There's been talk for a while about Monaco's place on the F1 calendar potentially being in danger. How serious is that threat right now?
I think it's more serious than it's ever been in the past, just because I think that I just don't think Monaco's an untouchable, invincible race anymore. I've written an article that you might have, by the time this comes out, you might have read it on the race website, on why Monaco's place on the calendar is no longer untouchable. There have been some comments from the Automobile Club de Monaco where they've basically dismissed any suggestion that the race is under threat as fake news. That is pretty much what they've said. But it's one of those weird things where the specifics of what they seem to have a problem with isn't really what's being suggested. They've basically said that it's wrong to suggest there will be difficulties in the race continuing beyond 2022 and that Liberty's asking for too much money, because no one's really said that. Where there's a risk is Monaco, I think, not being a permanent race anymore and being one of those races that switches onto a rotation, so becomes a biennial event or something like that. You know, there is room for the ACM's position and what we're saying here for both of those things to be true. There's no contract in place beyond 2022. They are looking at getting a new short-term deal. Maybe a bit longer than that, maybe medium term, 5 years or something like that. But even if the Monaco Grand Prix does get a new deal and is held every year for the next 5 years, that doesn't change the fact that it's more vulnerable. The race's status is definitely lower than it used to be, or at least is in the eyes of Formula One. I think the addition of races like Las Vegas and Miami, which are ones that Liberty Media have properly pursued, that F1 genuinely believes that these races are going to become the destination races. You know, the big, glitzy, glamorous ones, the ones all the celebrities want to go to, the ones that commercial partners want to be part of. That is where F1 sees it going. And because of that, Monaco's, you know, the jewel in the crown just gets a bit less shiny. It's downgraded, and it will still have elements that other races lack. It will still be, I think, the big showpiece round in Europe for as long as it's around for. But it just seems to be one where F1, I feel, is willing to call its bluff a little bit. Ultimately, the Monaco side of things has been arrogant over the years. It's got more favourable terms than any other race on the calendar. It doesn't have a no hosting fee, but it definitely has a lower fee than any other race. It's got its own unique broadcast deal in terms of running everything itself, and it's always been completely immune to calls to seriously look into changing the layout or doing something to improve the quality of racing. For a long time, it's felt like Monaco is just on the calendar because it's Monaco, but I don't think that's enough for Formula One anymore when there's so much interest in races, and we're moving into a point where rotation is absolutely imminent. You know, France is almost certainly going to drop off the calendar next year, but it's not going to disappear forever. So if France disappears in 2023, it might be back in 2024. This is the era of Formula One that we're moving into in terms of European races. And I just think that Monaco is more vulnerable to being part of that rotation than you would ever have imagined. And although it's unthinkable to some people, that I think that's the reality. Even if it's around for a bit longer, permanently, I don't think that's a given anymore, that Monaco is just going to always be there.
It should be noted, though, that Monaco a few years ago put the value of the race to it at about $1 billion, something like that, in terms of the interest and the fans attending and the economic benefit, which is perhaps not the best negotiating position to create given they had a cheap deal. But anyway, should we get Judge Hughes to adjudicate on this? Just looking at this less from a commercial perspective and more just from the perspective of its value to Formula One, is it unthinkable for the Monaco Grand Prix not to happen even every other year? Or do you think F1 should be willing to let it slide if necessary?
Oh, I think it's absolutely feasible that it could be every other year at some point in the future. I think...
Feasible, but is it right?
Is it right? No, I don't have an opinion on whether it's right or wrong. It's just whether it's... whether it's realistic. Traditionalists would say it must be on the calendar. I really don't have that bigger identification with that view. It's got its own unique character, but so is everywhere we go, really. But that's, yeah. I think it should be concerned, and I think it should be looking to see how it can accommodate F1, and in this time when we're talking about trying to fit 30 races in at some point in the near future, I don't think any race can take it as that it's got a guaranteed place on the calendar.
Yeah, I think you're certainly right that it is vulnerable and it is feasible this could happen. But the thing that I'd be wary about is just any kind of dilution of that unique driving challenge. No other circuit exists like Monaco in terms of that exact challenge, and I don't think any other new street circuit could that matches it, which is why I'd be very, very keen for it to remain and be on the calendar every year, but not at any cost, obviously. That's a difficult thing. But it's such a great place to watch Grand Prix drivers in action from trackside. Some of my best memories are from watching that.
But what does Monaco have that somewhere like Singapore, for example, doesn't have? Because to me, Singapore, I honestly, this is not a flippant position. Singapore to me is a better version of Monaco. It's a longer track. There is actually at least the possibility of passing in Singapore. It's a colossal challenge. And when you have a qualifying lap on the limit in Singapore, it's absolutely mega. Thinking, we've seen laps like that from Charles Leclerc's pole lap in... I think Charles Leclerc was on pole in 2019. Lewis's pole lap there the year before or a couple of years before that. That's obviously one of the standout ones as well. Singapore creates these moments, and yet it isn't a guaranteed rubbish Grand Prix. And to me, Monaco, it's dead after Saturday. Qualifying in Monaco is mega, but the race is something I absolutely do not look forward to. So if you are arguing on the unique nature of the challenge of Monaco, Ed, I put to you that Monaco is no better a challenge than Singapore.
I think it's a different challenge. Singapore's great, but Monaco's narrower, those aged streets clinging to the edge of the cliff face, effectively. It just creates a unique challenge in terms of those undulations, just the shape of the track, the various protrusions where things aren't quite as they should be. Singapore's good, but it is basically laid out on what's almost a grid layout, isn't it? I certainly am not arguing that Singapore's not a good street track, but it has its own challenge. But Monaco is that unique one. And I don't think there's anywhere else, except for that brief moment where they wend by the through the National Heritage Site in Baku, which is only a few metres, obviously, the castle section, as it's called. That's the only place where you recapture that. And that's what I'd be concerned about, because if you were to propose Monaco as a circuit for a new Grand Prix now, I know the FIA is willing to make some allowances for street circuits and temporary circuits and that kind of thing, but it wouldn't get anywhere near. And that's the thing I'd be a little bit wary about. I do agree 100% with you, though, that the race is not usually that thrilling, but it still has produced some interesting moments over recent years. So for me, it's as a one-off, it's good for the variety, and we lose variety in the calendar and variety of driving challenge if it disappeared. Doesn't mean they shouldn't look at modifying the track to improve the racing, although given the geographical constraints, I think any improvement would be marginal, to say the least.
I think my problem with somewhere like Monaco is just that even in recent years, the good moments, the good races we've seen in recent years, they just come, like, their redeeming feature is that you can't overtake at Monaco. That's what makes a good race in Monaco, is that you can't get past. Things like Daniel Ricciardo hanging on when he had the MGUK failure, wasn't it, that year. He drove brilliantly, and I thought that was an absolutely spellbinding race to watch. I will admit that. But it was predicated on the fact that you can't overtake in Monaco. It wouldn't have been possible anywhere else. And when we've had thrilling conclusions to Grand Prix, like Max Verstappen chasing down Lewis Hamilton, for example, which would have been in 2019, I think. Again, I know Max absolutely launched one into the chicane coming out of the tunnel, and they made contact and carried on. At the time, we should have seen that as a precursor to 2021, to be honest. But again, there's just something about that. Like, there's not the same jeopardy there. There's not the same interest for me as there is at another Grand Prix, because I'm just never expecting there to be that conclusion. I don't feel like you're building to something in Monaco, because I just don't think it's possible for anything to happen unless someone does something absolutely ridiculous and basically tries to take out both cars.
Yeah, the likelihood of something happening is low. It does build. Qualifying is the crescendo that weekend, but I don't mind that for one race. There's 22, 23 other races on the calendar where you do have that racing opportunity. So that's my position on it anyway. The one thing I am aware of is that we do have the privilege of watching the cars trackside there. And although it does translate partly over TV, I can understand why people watching at home don't necessarily see it in quite the same way. So I get why people are critical of that race. But I think it's a bit of a careful what you wish for thing for those who would like to see it dropped, because I think F1 would miss it. Remember Hockenheim? Everyone used to say that was boring with the long straight, so now everyone misses it because it's been replaced by a circuit that, well, when it was used in F1, was fairly nondescript, although it did produce some interesting races. Mark, let's move on to the coming weekend, the Emilia-Romagna Grand Prix at Imola, first sprint race weekend of the year. Format similar to last year, so how do you expect that to impact the race weekend?
Well, the sprint race puts a different onus on different drivers and teams depending on their competitiveness. So Fernando Alonso, for example, he can more readily go for a take-no-prisoners approach to improving his grid position for Sunday's race by being super aggressive on the opening laps of a sprint race, like we saw at Silverstone last year. But a Charles Leclerc or Max Verstappen or a Carlos Sainz can't really take those risks unless they've qualified badly for the sprint. And I guess the Mercedes drivers are now in the Fernando Alonso position, where it's probably worth you know, putting a bit of risk in to try and overachieve. And if you look at when Lewis got ahead of Perez for 10 laps in at the start at Melbourne, he was never going to keep that place because he was against a much faster car, but he did it for as long as he could. That's feasible to hold on to that place in a short duration sprint race. So it might be worth just having a little bit more, take no prisoners approach on the opening laps to try and get a position like that. It's just a subtly different dynamic to the main race. Of course, Imola, the penalty for an optimistic passing attempt or a hard defence, it's pretty high. A lot of solid things to hit. And you recall George Russell and Valtteri Bottas' accident last year there in the race, or Yuki Tsunoda's in qualifying. This increased jeopardy just makes that distinction and approach, you know, more stark. It doesn't really revolutionise the race weekend. It just gives it a slightly different tempo and potentially throws in a few more randoms. There's less time to experiment. There's less long run preparation, but that's the same for everyone. But I guess it should generally favour the cars in that respect, with the ones with the widest setup windows, and that sounds a bit like a Ferrari.
And we will see Scott points down to eighth place in the sprint race, 8 points for a win down to one, and of course official pole position goes to the fastest driver overlapping qualifying, which I quite like, even though it's been criticised, because I think the pole position stat is only worth anything if it's a recognition who's been fastest in qualifying. It's not simply a mundane record of who started at the front in the race. But do you think that point changes to the benefit, or is it fairly neutral? Yeah, there's more points, but there's more points if you're directly behind, so the gap is only 1 point per position still, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's difficult to really expect that to change anything, to be honest, because yeah, there is a little bit more on offer if you overtake, but you've also now got something to lose. So if you're outside of the top three and you're not entirely sure you can really, you don't have a drive-by overtake presenting itself, and Mark was just explaining the treacherous nature of trying to make a pass at Imola. Why would you, if you're fourth or fifth or something like that, why would you sacrifice, you're nailed on grid position and a couple of points or whatever it is that you're holding on to for the sake of one place, one point? I just don't think the reward outweighs the risk in that situation. And again, like most changes we see in Formula One, the most likely place it'll have an impact is bang in the middle of that midfield where it's ultra close and there is the possibility of gaining a couple of places and turning a position and no points into a much better grid position and 2 or 3 points if you get it absolutely right. If you do a Fernando Alonso, for example, and absolutely smash the sprint race like he did at Silverstone. Otherwise, I think it'll be much, much the same. I think it is. I am just quite curious to see how it works with the new cars. That's the only thing I have really that I'm intrigued about with the sprints for this year, because I thought they had potential last year. I don't think they were a complete write-off in terms of an idea or in practice. They worked as I expected, if not slightly better, to be honest, but I didn't have the outrageously high expectations for it that Ross Brawn would have liked a few people to have had in the first instance. So let's see how it goes with the new cars. I'm sure there'll be lots of following and an intense battle, but I just think it'll be something that we focus on in the midfield rather than at the front. I can't imagine that we're going to see Leclerc and Verstappen going at it in a sprint race quite how we saw them do in Bahrain or Saudi Arabia or even at that safety car restart in Australia.
And given it's only one free practice session before qualifying on Friday, we're not expecting to see much in the way of upgrades. Ferrari have already said they won't be bringing much. Mercedes have downplayed any expectations of anything other than incremental improvements, and you won't have much time to try them out. But Mark, in terms of the balance of power between Ferrari and Red Bull at the front, what would your expectation be going into the weekend into what the balance of power would be there? Would it again be Ferrari potentially in better shape in qualifying, as we've seen in two of the three races so far, but then maybe in the race Red Bull's stronger as it was in the first two?
I think if you look at where the Ferrari's been quick over the Red Bull in terms of corner speeds, I think Imola should actually be better suited to the Ferrari than Jeddah or Melbourne was. So, yeah, I think Red Bull goes into this definitely second favourites into this weekend, regardless of reliability or anything, just in terms of sheer pace. I would say, Ferrari's probably going to be favourite to be the fastest to the place.
And if that's the case, Scott, it's going to be a big weekend for Carlos Sainz, isn't it?
Yep, he's got a lot of work to do. I think he's got to quickly bounce back from what happened in Australia. I think he has to take the positives from that weekend where he was very, very good. He lost his head when it mattered in the Grand Prix, but that was because of yet more bad luck going or falling his way. It all unraveled at the start of Q3, and that's all obviously he will remember and that we remember from that weekend. It's all we've talked about. But before that, there was a lot of good about Sainz's weekend. He has a lot of work to do now to ensure that he is not just written off as Ferrari's number two already, three races into the season. What better place to do that than on home soil for the team in Italy?
Yeah, he'd love a first win at Imola. That would be a great place to do it, Tifosi-wise, and certainly kickstart his season after a tricky start. Well, thanks very much to Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes for your insight. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen, as there's loads to read there. Also, have a listen to our sister podcast covering IndyCar, Formula E and MotoGP, and head to our YouTube channel where there's a constant stream of F1 videos. We're heading to Italy now, so stay with us for everything you need to know from Imola.
The Athletic.